Stay tuned for a Juno Afternoon. We'll hear an interview with Sasha Sobeloff by Trip Krause. Sean Strauss from the Marie Drake Planetarium will be here to give us a preview of the program on the Cassini spacecraft, which is tomorrow evening. And Pat Race will offer a preview of this week's Jump Festival. That's Juno Independent Filmmaking Festival. That, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, Music, and more. That's next. Taking a look at the weather, showers likely continuing this afternoon, tonight with heavy rain tomorrow, decreasing to scattered showers Tuesday night, Wednesday chance of shower at about 50%. Stay tuned for Juno Afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Native American artists say counterfeit Indian art and jewelry continues to be a problem across the country. Artists made the comments Friday in Santa Fe, New Mexico, at a U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs field hearing about efforts to prevent the marketing and sale of counterfeit tribal art. Native artists say fake art not only impacts the income of artists, but also hurts them culturally and rips off buyers. Artists say Native art is about culture, identity, and healing. Joyce Begay-Foss, a Navajo weaver, says the appropriation and profiting from Native art is disturbing. She says for Navajo people, weaving is not just an art form, but a connection to the environment and life ways.
Our earliest designs came from our baskets, and then they went into, transitioned into our women dresses, our chief blankets, shoulder, and child blankets. These textiles were finely woven from hand-spun, warp, and weft woolen yarns. So the colors are limited to natural brown, white, black, and indigo dyed yarns. In these textiles, patterns were specifically woven a certain color and placement for a reason. However, today the import market has taken some of these very traditional designs and have displaced or rearranged them in knockoffs that I find offensive.
Begay-Foss says regional styles from across the Navajo Reservation are also being appropriated. Artists at the field hearing say the modernization of federal law needs to happen to protect Indian arts and crafts, as well as the enforcement of the law. Another way to protect Indian arts, they say, is to educate consumers about authenticity. The hearing was also an opportunity for tribal leaders, experts, and law enforcement officials to give input on the Indian Arts and Crafts Act of 1990. The Truth in Advertising Law prohibits the misrepresentation and marketing of Indian arts and crafts products in the United States and imposes criminal and civil penalties. U.S. New Mexico Senator Tom Udall, who chaired the hearing, says he plans to introduce legislation based on information gathered from the witnesses. Penobscot Nation leaders and tribal members rallied Sunday in Bangor, Maine. Chief Kirk Francis and others say they will continue to stand for tribal sovereignty and rights to waterways. The gathering was in response to a June 30th appeals court decision against the tribe. The U.S. Court of Appeals ruled the river surrounding the tribe's reservation island is not part of the tribe's territory. The tribe says the ruling sanctions the state in taking of Penobscot ancestral waterways, and the tribe will not give up the fight over the river. The World Indigenous Games has come to an end after a week of competition in Alberta. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, many of the participants say it was a positive experience.
The 2017 World Indigenous Games opened a week ago with some 2,000 athletes from 30 countries taking part. Organizers say it was an opportunity for the athletes to bring Indigenous people together, to celebrate and highlight their cultures, and to build a sense of pride. And that's what most of the volunteers and participants took away with them.
We love it here. The place here is really good. The people are friendly. It's just really good.
Meeting new people was honestly the best thing ever. I'm so blessed to be out here.
We've all traded so far, and we're trying to like meet new people and trade jackets.
The competitions included sports such as soccer, basketball, lacrosse, swimming, archery, and the wild horse relay. Organizers say it's more than just spreading awareness about past histories. They say the games are more about a celebration of the world's indigenous people. The world's first indigenous games were held 2 years ago in Brazil. And while the current games held in Alberta had a few minor problems, the consensus is they were a success. Now organizers are already holding talks about where the next set of games will take place. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation. with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
The third National Gathering of American Indian Veterans is July 21st through the 23rd in Wheaton, Illinois. Meet Native World War II D-Day survivor Charles Norman Shea. Information at trickstergallery.com. Proud to support this program.
And by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Congratulations to the Southeast Alaska State Fair for choosing clean air. The Haines Fairgrounds are now smoke-free year-round. Eliminating exposure to secondhand smoke where we live, work, and play strengthens our communities for generations to come. Thinking of quitting? For free support, call Alaska's Tobacco Quitline at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message is brought to you by the Partnership for a Tobacco-Free Southeast and SEARCH.
And welcome to a Juneau Afternoon. I'm this afternoon's volunteer host, Lori Scandling. Jeff Brown is our producer, and he's on the board. I'm pleased to welcome back guests from Maud Carousel, Seneca Harper. He is from Juneau. His performing name is Luminous Pariah, and his colleague, Moscato Extatique. And they had a successful show this weekend at the Rockwell, and they have additional shows coming up this following weekend around the theme called Gilded. For those who did not hear our recent chat, Seneca, talk a little bit about how you would describe the show Maud Carousel for the uninitiated who would like to know a little bit more.
For your inaugurative experience seeing Maud Carousel, I would expect to see, or I would tell you to expect to see, a cabaret. So think of eyelashes, think of hats, think of sequins and rhinestones, sometimes high heels, sometimes skirts, sometimes trousers, tuxedos, gowns, things like this.
And these are all gentlemen who are doing this performance. So when we talk about eyelashes and high heels, mm-hmm. as you mentioned the other day, a great term might be boylesque,
yeah.
taking off the burlesque tradition, but the roles are played by males.
Exactly. So this last weekend, I actually emceed our show, and I've emceed numerous shows, but I've never emceed ours. And we're inviting up Kayla Bailey, who is biologically female. Mm-hmm. She is a singer and a musician and a wonderful MC. So she'll be here, but you're right, boylesque is how would you describe Moscato? How would you describe boylesque?
I would describe boylesque as basically burlesque presented as male. Women and men can present boylesque on stage. It's just kind of presenting masculine ideas, or you know, whether or not you identify as male and you're doing burlesque.
The typical formula for that is a performer enters the stage, they establish some sort of character and storyline, magic happens, their clothing begins to get smaller and smaller as they transition through their story. At the end of the act, they are wearing a lot less than they entered the stage with, and you kind of, I don't know, I guess there's a little surprise at the end of each act.
When you say surprise, are we talking full frontal hair or
no?
Okay.
You always have to leave something to the imagination.
I was surprised when we chatted last week, the degree to which you've traveled the world with this show. Talk a little bit about those overseas experiences and how they came about.
The first time Maud Carousel had our group invitation to go overseas was to London, actually. And it's because there was a Seattle photographer who had a residency. He lived in London for 10 years before. He made a hobby of photographing burlesque performers in Seattle, and he decided to mount an exhibit at a place called the Brick House in London. And it was a club that one of his friends owns. And his friend said, well, how about we do a cross promotion here, and how about you invite some of those performers in these photographs to perform at London, in the Brick House here. So initially, that was our first time traveling abroad. And it was wonderful. It was so exciting. We started to meet all these other performers and all these other producers, and it just kind of snowballs from there. People start inviting you to things. And then, of course, our Blurred Lines video that Trojan spearheaded a few years ago went viral, and that's when we had invitations for more places from
there. You mentioned Finland. Is that, yeah. Or is that pending? I'm trying to recall.
No, Finland is it's a show. It's called Party on the River. It's a boat that I'll be performing on in Turku, which is a small city just outside of Helsinki. So I've been there a number of times, and I'm really excited to go back.
Seneca, you grew up in Juneau. Did you ever envision yourself as a performer on stages around the world?
The funny thing is, that was my main goal. Leaving Juneau, I wanted to move, you know, to New York City or somewhere. So I went to Seattle to study theater, and then I decided very quickly I wanted to be a scientist. And then I burnt myself out working 40 hours a week as a barista and taking full course load. So I said, you know what, I'll take one quarter off of school, and then I'll slowly go back to school. During that quarter, I stumbled across burlesque, and that was almost 9 years ago.
How did the stumble happen? Did you see a show or make an acquaintance?
A little bit of both. I saw a show, and then I made an acquaintance, because after the show, I had to know how to become involved in the world of burlesque. And sure enough, it was a burlesque series, very much like the series that Moscato actually graduated from.
Moscato, you went to the Cornish School of Arts, if I recall correctly.
Yes,
is that right? And what was your entree then into burlesque from that school? Was it a part of the course offerings?
It was an elective in the theater department. I studied dance, and I was just so intrigued that my college offered burlesque, and I just had to take it out of curiosity. Through that course, Seneca actually spoke on a panel, and I was just really excited, and I just needed to know more. So I got as much information as I could from him, and I met all the members of Mod Carousel, and from there I just like dove into burlesque while still in college.
Tell me a quick history, if you can, about the origins of burlesque. I think of Germany, 1930. What is the root of burlesque? Is that addressed in the class?
Yes, we discussed a lot of the history of burlesque, which, you know, can date back to Shakespearean era, but it also just depends on how you really want to look at it. Like, burlesque means to make parody of, you know? So back then, burlesque was basically the SNL of that time. And it evolved to being, you know, I mean, it was all men on stage. Eventually, women started to take the stage, and it became a little more risque. And, you know, it started to evolve when it came to America, where, you know, clothes started coming off, and, you know, it became about captivating audiences and making comedy and, you know, in the 50s, it started to compete more with film, and, you know, they wanted to get more people to come to the shows. They had to compete with these things. So it evolved through the years. I mean, I feel as though it is seen in dance, in theater, in so many aspects of art. It's not just this one genre.
We're talking with Seneca Harper. He is a Juno person who performs as Luminous Pariah, and his colleague, Moscato Extatique, and they have a second show this coming weekend at the Rockwell, 7 o'clock Friday and 7 o'clock and 10 o'clock on Saturday. Tickets are $20 in advance. How long has Mod Carousel been together?
We've been together for 9 years, and this is our 8th year in Juno.
And how did the Juno connection get initiated? Was it you reconnecting with your hometown?
It was, yeah. I wanted to come back here, and it was just after I had graduated from my little Academy of Burlesque in Seattle, and I said, you know what, if I'm going up there, I bet there's a show happening, and a friend of mine was putting on a belly dance show at the Rendezvous, very small, informal thing, and I thought, well, it's definitely going out on a limb. I don't think this is something Juno people are used to seeing, and I used that kind of nervousness to actually create one of the acts that became my signature act, and that says a fisherman who wrestles a salmon out of the water, and I kill it with my bare hands, and I gut it, and inside I discover a high heel, and you can kind of guess how the act evolves from there. So
is an Academy of Burlesque.
There is. There are several all around the world, actually.
How long is the time of study, and do you actually get a certificate or something that indicates you have followed a certain academic training?
You do. Each of them are varying levels of intensity. The one that I took was a shorter one. It was a 6-week course.
I see.
Yeah.
I want to recognize for our listeners that each of you has an ethnic background that I would not say is necessarily Anglo-European, if I might say that. This leads to a question of, as you have met other burlesque performers in other parts of the United States and the world, do you see a diversity of performers in this field, or is it more dominated by one group of folks or another? What have you learned about that?
It's a little bit of a tricky question because a lot of the travel that I do is in still ethnically homogenous countries. You know, like Germany, you have places like Berlin, which I love, and I was planning on moving there for a little while. Very, very blended, but still, Germany as a country is mostly German people who've been there for hundreds and hundreds of years, and that's the same with all of Scandinavia, you know, Finland and Iceland and Sweden. So there, most of those performers do look like you would expect them to look, but
like countrymen and women.
Yeah, exactly.
Sure.
As you get into places like London and Paris and New York City and Seattle, Los Angeles, then you start to really get more of a mix. So I think that the burlesque scenes mostly reflect the population that immediately surrounds them.
And either one of you can answer this. Do you find European audiences more open to risque performances? I know that when I've traveled in Europe, they permitted, for example, nudity on television way, way before HBO began to include that as part of their regular programming. What's been your experience in kind of feeling out audiences and their receptivity?
I think it really, really depends on the city and more specifically the venue. For instance, our first run of shows in London, we seemed to scandalize so many people. They're like, wow, the men, they're wearing eyelashes. I've never seen this, but really, I haven't seen men in eyelashes before. And then I actually had my first full frontal, it wasn't full frontal, it was just nudity, and I was strategically covered, but I'm always wearing something. But in Berlin, I had forgotten a costume piece. And I thought to myself, well, I could either wear something that doesn't match, or I can just go with the true Weimar cabaret tradition and bear all.
So there was a wardrobe malfunction, shall we say?
Yes, we can call it that. Yeah.
How'd that go over?
It was actually fine, you know, and of course I feel like I have enough skill as a mover and a theater person to be able to cover that up. So nobody really knew exactly what happened, but everyone had a great time.
Moscato, what has been one of your favorite roles or any story that you can tell that happened on stage that might have been a surprise to you that you had to adjust to?
I think as a performer, I'm constantly learning on stage what works and what doesn't. I think as you premiere new acts, like I did this past weekend, you have expectations that you're thinking like, oh, they will love this. The audience is going to take this in so well. And then you're on stage and no one's reacting.
Ooh.
And you're just like, okay, what do I need to do to connect to this audience? And that's one of my favorite parts of this job is being able to, like, grow with the audience and have them teach me something new.
And when it's live, it's got to be spontaneous.
Exactly. It's always different every show. Like, you never have the same audience, and it's just so exciting and thrilling.
Will you be introducing any new things this coming weekend?
Yes. We have a couple of... Actually, all of us are performing new solos that we've never done here. And we've got a great group number that is a surprise. I don't want to give too much away, but there's definitely some great
things
coming.
You're looking coy right now. I'm just going to share that. We're chatting with two performers with the Boylesque Group Mod Carousel. This is their eighth year performing in Juneau. If you'd like to check them out, 7 o'clock Friday and Saturday night at Rockwell with a 10 o'clock performance also on Saturday night. Good to have you back with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday, the 10th of July, 2017. The birthday of Marcel Proust, born in Autoy, France, in 1871, best known for his seven-volume Remembrance of Things Past, also known more literally as In Search of Lost Time. Proust's own life story, which came out between 1913 and 1927, with the famous scene early in the book in which the narrator dips a bit of a madeleine in some tea and experiences a memory from his childhood. It's the birthday of the inventor Nikola Tesla, born in Austria-Hungary, now Croatia, 1856. He invented the rotating magnetic field, the basis for alternating current machinery. also invented the Tesla induction coil, an essential component in radio technology. Came to America in 1884 and designed one of the first hydroelectric power plants in the country. It was at Niagara Falls, supplied power to the city of Buffalo, New York. It's the birthday of the theologian John Calvin, born in Picardy, France, in 1509, who, in his early 20s, while working as a lawyer, had an epiphany and left the Roman Catholic Church to join the Protestant faith. At a time when Protestants were still being declared heretics and burned at the stake, he went to Geneva, Switzerland. He preached at least once a day for over an hour, using no notes, and in 1536 he published The Principles of Calvinism. Total depravity, all people are born sinful, unconditional election, that is, God has already chosen those people who will be saved, limited atonement, Jesus died to atone for the sins of the elect only, irresistible grace, if you're among the elect, you will inevitably repent and become a Christian, and perseverance of the saints. You can never lose your salvation. The five principles, total depravity, unconditional election, limited atonement, irresistible grace, and perseverance of the saints, which spell out the word tulip. John Calvin, who died in 1564, and who, along with Martin Luther, is the most important figure in the second generation of the Protestant Reformation. Here's a poem for today by Anya Krugavoy-Silver, Woman with a Hole in Her Stocking. Such a universal female gesture, a woman grabbing the seam of her stocking, tugging it forward over the exposed toe, tucking it under her foot, so the tear won't show. There's something graceful and humble about the way she will balance crane-like on one foot, cradling the other in her hand, her back bent, her face tilted downward, trying to hide the damage of the splintered floorboard or untrimmed toenail. Sometimes, while she's leaning over, a strand will float loose from its ponytail. Then she'll stand recombing her hair with her hands, repair after tiny repair. Woman with a Hole in Her Stocking, a poem by Anya Krugavoy-Silver, from Nothing, published by Louisiana State University Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by Progressive Insurance, committed to offering a streamlined shopping experience where home and auto can be bundled together. Now that's Progressive. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. And by Home Advisor, matching homeowners with background-checked professionals for home projects from minor repairs to major remodels. See homeowner reviews, compare prices, and book appointments at homeadvisor.com. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Glad to have you with us on a Juno afternoon. I'm today's volunteer host, Lori Scandling. My next guest is Sean Strauss. He is a volunteer with the Marie Drake Planetarium, which tomorrow evening at 7 will have a free family program on the Cassini spacecraft. Welcome, Sean. Glad to have you back in Juno. What has been your association with the Marie Drake Planetarium?
I started volunteering in the planetarium 1993 or 94. I spent about 10 years there, and I left Juneau for Los Angeles for another 10 years, and this is my first show with the planetarium in 12 to 15 years.
Are you nervous?
I am nervous.
Is it complicated equipment to learn how to use?
Some of it's complicated, certainly, but anybody with knowledge of astronomy and a willingness to learn is welcome to volunteer at our planetarium.
I understand that our planetarium is the
largest in Alaska?
That's right. There are only two in Alaska, and ours is larger than the one in Anchorage.
And for folks who might not be aware of this hidden gem in our community, it is in the former Marie Drake Middle School building, which is sits next to Harbor View, and on the other side of that is Juno Douglas High School. So that's where that is. And the planetarium shape is quite obvious when you're outside looking at the building.
Yes, you can see the dome on the ceiling just above the main entrance.
What was your entree to astronomy? What snagged your interest in this area?
Oh, that's a great question. I loved learning about Jupiter and the fact that we live on a planet and that the sun is a star. Learning about astronomy as a kid just became a passion, and I followed it throughout my life.
And of course, the recent, not too distant in the past, pictures of Jupiter and of Saturn's rings recently have been so stunning, and it feels like we're getting closer and closer to our neighbors in our own little solar system.
Actually, just 2 years ago, we had a spacecraft that finally visited Pluto, the planet Pluto. And yes, I call it a planet. And that actually marked a major achievement by humanity. Over the past 50 years, we have explored every planet in our solar system. It's hard to think of achievements greater than that by humanity.
Is the United States still a leader in this, Sean? I think about my own childhood, where reaching the moon, which was very much an analogy in terms of our competition to be a world power, particularly with the Soviet Union at that time, caused us to set a goal of reaching the moon. Do you see the United States still a leader in this area?
I do. Certainly our leaders have made it clear that we will go back to the moon, that we will again put humans on the moon, and that we will, in the near future after that, put humans on Mars.
I understand. In fact, there's been a goal date set for landing on Mars. I want to say it's 2030 because I remember doing the math thinking, will I be alive? I hope so.
I think that's about right, but you have to remember that the Apollo spacecraft, when they put humans on the moon, it took 3 days just to get to the moon. If Earth and Mars are aligned properly, the closest they will get, it would take 90 days to get to Mars. So these are not easy trips by any measure. These will be very difficult. They will be very dangerous. But it's hard to imagine something more awesome than having people permanently living in other places in our solar system.
And, of course, that popular movie, The Martian, was just out last year, gave us a sense of some of the challenges that might be present just for everyday activity.
Yes, survival is not easy.
I don't know if you read the book, but the mathematical calculations were mind-blowing, and the gentleman definitely did his research. Well, let's talk about tomorrow's program at the Marie Drake Planetarium. It is about the Cassini spacecraft, and I understand the program is free. Donations are always welcome, but it's at 7 o'clock. Is that correct?
That's correct. We are planning one show, and if there happen to be a number of people that are wanting more, I'm willing to personally put on another show at 8 o'clock.
It
depends
fantastic.
On attendance.
It's a real family-friendly facility.
I think so.
Let's talk about the Cassini spacecraft. It is in its 20th anniversary, if I understand that correctly. Talk a little bit about its significance, please.
Okay, well, I call the Cassini spacecraft the best yet because it has achieved so much. It was about 20 years ago that it was launched from Earth. It took 7 years just to get to Saturn, and for the last 13 years, it's been orbiting Saturn again and again, taking amazing photographs, collecting tremendous amount of information and sending that data back to Earth. And we're now at the point where it's virtually out of fuel. So as a grand finale, to make sure that it does not contaminate any of the moons, it is going to it's going to be plunging into the atmosphere of Saturn and burn up.
Ooh, that's dramatic.
It is. It's
will we
quite
see
exciting.
Any photos tomorrow night taken by Cassini of Saturn?
We will see many photos. I'm going to try to put on a few videos as well. And certainly everything that I talk about will include information about how we achieved that tremendous trajectory, leaving Earth, arriving at Saturn 7 years later. I'll be talking about what we've learned about the planet, including this incredible storm on the North Pole that's in the shape of a hexagon. I'll talk about the rings of Saturn, the moons of Saturn, a probe from Cassini that actually landed on one of the moons, Titan, and we'll talk about the crown jewel discovery of Cassini, which is that one of the moons, Enceladus, has what's called a global subsurface ocean. Simply put, the core of that moon is surrounded entirely by water, and that is surrounded by an icy shell. We've seen oceans. We have oceans on our planet. But to find a global ocean that is underneath the surface of the ice, it was something that was believed to existed. We theorize it. Scientists predicted it. And Cassini was the first to discover that Enceladus has this global ocean.
When is Cassini's death day? Is that already known?
It is, and it will be mid-September, September 15th. It is now in the process of the grand finale. It is orbiting laps around Saturn, getting closer and closer. Even now, the closest that it's gotten is within the rings of Saturn, and the last one, which will be mid-September, it's going to get so close that it gets captured by the atmosphere and burns up in again. Now, again, the reason for this, its planned destruction, is because there's a small chance that there's a contaminant from Earth. We don't want that contaminant to land on a moon where it would truly contaminate it. We want to find out what these moons are in pristine condition. We want to keep them pristine. So that's why, with it virtually out of fuel, we can control its descent so it's destroyed properly.
What has been the fuel source for Cassini, and how big a craft is it? Help us picture it.
That's a good question. I think Cassini is about as large as a small car, and that included the probe that detached and landed on the moon Titan. Its power source is a plug of plutonium. It is radioactive, and that has been the source of power.
And I'm just imagining the degree to which technology has rapidly advanced just in the years that the spacecraft has been in space since it departed Earth. How is it controlled? Is it through a bank? I'm picturing, you know, folks sitting at a bank of computers there at the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena. How is the Cassini controlled?
That's a great question. Bottom line, Cassini sends information back to Earth and has a satellite dish so it can receive information. The information that we send is to turn on its engines at such and such time and then turn it off after 20 seconds.
That's the total complexity of the orders that it's receiving?
That's about moving it. It also, they'll have it so it shifts and points in a different direction. The orders include take pictures of this, analyze that, change its direction so it's now pointing at this moon, change the direction so we're now focusing on the planet itself. Point towards Earth, send all that information back to Earth, wait 3 days until new information, new instructions are received.
So it's a three-day, one-way trip.
3 days for the scientists to analyze and go, what are we going to do? How are we going to make sure this? How are we going to take pictures of this? Oh, we're going to get close to this moon. Now, it takes about 5 minutes. Actually, it's 1 billion miles from Earth. That's how far Saturn is. Now, I can't quite do the math in my head, but it takes light, I think, half an hour to get from Earth to Saturn. So that's how much time it takes, about half an hour, for the information
to
send. That's right. So anything we get is at least half an hour old.
It's almost analogous to sending messages across the Atlantic as leaders tried to communicate, whether it was during the Revolution or the Civil War. You know, it's all relative, isn't it?
That's right. When we get information, by the time we get it, circumstances have already changed. If we look out into the night sky and see a star, that star is no longer there. That star was there 3 years ago, or maybe 3 million years ago. That's how far away it is, because we don't get that information. We don't see the star until that much time
until the light reaches us.
That's right. And by then, the star is in a different place. It may have even exploded, and we don't know about it.
I was talking about the space-time warp here. You do know that, Sean.
Yes.
My mind is already bending. Now, is Cassini, is it named after a scientist, after a constellation? Do you know the significance of the name of this spacecraft?
I do. I just spent a little time learning about Giovanni Domenico Cassini. He was a man who was born in Italy and spent the rest of his life in France. He was an astronomer, and he studied science, he studied mathematics.
What period are we talking?
He was born, I think, in about the 1620s, and he died just before 1700. He was a topographer and helped begin a topological map of the entire country of France. It wasn't even completed until after his death. And he discovered that the rings in Saturn have a gap. There are two main portions of the rings of Saturn, and there's a gap in them. And it was Cassini who discovered this.
Such an apropos name, then. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Sean Strauss. He is a trained volunteer with the Marie Drake Planetarium. And tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock, if you are at all interested in the miraculous work and data collected and produced by the Cassini spacecraft, you can learn more about it tomorrow evening at the Marie Drake Planetarium. It is free. Donations are welcome, and the program starts at 7 o'clock. Sean, thanks for joining us. I'm excited, and I'll be there.
Thank you, Laurie. I look forward to it.
Sasha Sobolov is the Grand President of the Alaska Native Brotherhood, with which its partner organization, the Alaska Native Sisterhood, was formed to address discrimination against Alaska Natives. The organizations are more than 100 years old and have since added education as one of their key missions. The longtime educator is the son of Walter Sobolov, who was a Tlingit scholar, elder, and religious leader. Walter Sobolov died in 2011. KTOO's Trip Kraus sat down recently with his son, Sasha, to talk about the legacy of Roy and Elizabeth Paratrovich, the role of educating Alaska Natives, and the problems that occur when two cultures meet. We listen in as Trip and Sasha Sobolov talk about the Paratroviches encountering discrimination when they first moved to Juneau and how that fight is remembered and commemorated almost 75 years later.
I mean, we often have to deal with this issue of, a lot of the Anglo-Saxon, Anglo-centric people who feel like they have some sort of governorship over this area where I feel natives have lived forever. Do you feel like that was kind of a slap in the face for somebody to feel like they have some sort of cultural connection to a place to be told that, no, you can't live here?
Well, I wish that history could be differently than it unfolded, but of course it doesn't. You have to understand that I come from I was a preacher's kid all my life. When I went away to college and figured out what the Western world was all about, I ended up coming back in 1970 as an elementary school teacher and spent 31 years in the classroom, most of it here in southeastern Alaska. So I've taught at every level, and so I watch Native kids and non-Native kids learn. So my orientation and comments about is centered very much around the fact that you and I must communicate in English. And teachers teach minority students up here classrooms in English, and the great misnomer in that very carefully crafted dialogue, which was began in the late 1800s, early 1900s, when Sheldon Jackson first came to the territory, where he announced that they were going to have schools. And everybody went, yay, and then he said, and it's going to be in English. And they said, what? So this educational system that I'm a product of the Juneau school system, and my kids are a product of it, we all had to go through the same experience. What we ran into was the fact that the teachers would teach us this process, ABC, C, Dick and Jane run, and all of the pictures go with it. But what they didn't realize is that they were teaching this language to someone who doesn't think in English. And I've made a study over the last 20, well, going on most of my life, because I often say to this, when I graduated from J.D. High, there was 111 of us, and I was third from the bottom of the class. I was an athlete. I was a basketball player. I barely could read. I could barely write. I had a 1.357 GPA, but I went away to Fairbanks to figure out what was wrong. And what I found out was it wasn't that I was the problem. It was that I was trying to figure this English language out, but my brain doesn't translate that. As a matter of fact, it's almost the opposite of it. And I would often use the characteristic that as I taught this to teachers at the university level system, I would say to them, and all of them are white, some of them were black, some of them were different races, and I've said, here's the difference. I would say, I'm going to reach over and pick up this red apple, and I'd hold it up. And the teachers would look at me like, dude, you don't have anything in your hand. I said, that's right, because you are thinking that I am picking up an apple. And in reality, we who don't have that affinity with English can actually see the red apple. You can't. And that's the phenomena of trying to translate this stuff. So the entire cultural, it's almost a cultural dyslexic clash that continues to this day, is because all of this large Western society is in English, but the participants on the cultural side don't think in English. All the legends and stories are very oral. You'll not find the Tlingit language in a textbook or in a monograph. It's all orally translated. And what happens is that skill is the only skill that many Alaska Natives, many American Natives you bring to the classroom, is they are seeing, hearing learners. And that's what Roy and Elizabeth and my mom and dad ran into when they got here to Juneau. There was great discrimination. They saw the signs that said, no Indians or dogs allowed. And it was true. They turned them away. But Roy and Elizabeth and my mom and dad figured out, well, we're going to skin this cat another way. And so they mastered the language, the English language, and they began to analyze, what can we do to make this better? Well, that's when Roy kind of prompted his wife, let's take a look at, try to make this thing equal. And so they began this discriminatory process, and it was heard for a couple of years at the territorial legislature, but didn't go anywhere until Elizabeth decided that, well, it's time, you know, time after 1943 that we get serious about this. And the Alaska Native Brotherhood and Sisterhood were kind of the premier backers of that. Roy and Elizabeth were past grand presidents. My dad was a past grand president of the Alaska Native Brotherhood. And they testified that this American system should be equal. And if it isn't equal, meaning either we don't speak the language or we don't adhere to the laws and the statutes, then it should be stated so that it loops us in, that it gives us this status. Well, it went through. It was long before the Civil Rights Act by Martin Luther King. Elizabeth didn't necessarily pound on the desk, but she was one of the few the territory back then had a legislature which allowed people from the gallery to speak, and so she spoke in a very hotly contested, because it was there were pros legislators for it and there were people who were against it, and she said many things that were very, very true, that she would never have thought that she who just barely learned this language, and she characterized it by saying, "I am whom just barely out of savagery would have to remind a gentleman of the 5,000 years of recorded history behind them of our Bill of Rights." And that got their attention. And as they say in the history books, the rest is history.
We're going to move a little further into our conversation with Sasha Sobolev.
But it came not as a fluke, but it came as a determination that Roy and Elizabeth said very pronouncedly all through their adult life, that this society that we live in needs to be equal. The color of your skin and the way you think should have nothing to do with it. That's one of the things that was one of the most pronounced marks in the early territorial legislature, if not the state legislature, where the process was very, very anti-Native, very, very, the laws were not written to accommodate. I often contended that in today's world, I had to teach my kids about discrimination, because they were about ready to be run out of the school system because they were not learning. And I had to go teach this to the teachers, that they were seeing, hearing learners, and that they belonged to a particular group of Alaska Native people who have to read in English and learn in English, but the skill that they bring is that they have seeing and hearing. That's what guides them. And in the classroom, it's what the teacher says. It's what the teacher instructs you to do. So in today's world, the education world has really said, well, we're doing well. And of course, now we're sitting in a time when the honorable legislators haven't passed, lots of money falling all over the place, everybody's being cut. But the current dropout rate for the Alaska Natives in the state of Alaska has millennially, ever since 1959, well been in a 60.2, if not 65% average, where it just does not connect, and the system is not accommodating this dilemma that Elizabeth and Roy and my dad and my mom ran into when they were coming to Juneau. And that's not holding anybody pro or con. That's just a statement of fact. So as I said earlier, that we're having to discuss this in English, there's a whole similar dialogue going on in the back of my brain that's saying we have to very carefully lay out this dialogue, because even though it is in English, the depth and breadth of the understanding is not in the English thought. It's in the Native thought, where we think holistically, try to fit in, make the best of what we have.
That was Sasha Sobolev. He is an elder in our community, and he is the son of Walter Sobolev, who was a very well-known elder who died in 2011. That interview was conducted by KTOO's Trip J. Krause. Thank you so much, Trip, for that interview. My name is Lori Scantling. I'm this afternoon's volunteer host. Jeff Brown is our producer. My last guest today is Pat Race. He is a co-founder of the JUMP Society. JUMP stands for Juneau Underground Motion Picture. And their festival is beginning Thursday evening. Pat, how many years has the JUMP Society sponsored the film festival?
A million.
Oh, it feels that way, right, today, because you're getting ready for it, I'm sure.
It's been 15 years now, and we do two screenings each year, and then a lot of other little mini events in between, sometimes educational, things like that.
Mm-hmm. And what was the impetus for starting a motion picture opportunity here in Juneau?
Well, there was a lot of things. We went to school up in Fairbanks, and we screened films up there with our friends, and it was kind of a fun excuse to get together and share work with people. In Juneau, it's neat to see the community from that perspective. It's neat to see what different people's vision of Juneau is. So a lot of just different perceptions of you know, like what story they're telling or what themes they're exploring or what they're working on, and getting a lot of people together that have short films and sharing them in one place provides kind of a neat overview of, you know, what people are thinking about and doing.
What are some of the guidelines for those who wish to enter a submission? And is there still time? The festival begins, or the screenings begin Thursday evening.
Yeah, so there's a little sliver of time. If you get something in today or tomorrow, we'll still accept it. It would be a real stretch to drop something off on Wednesday. But, yeah, we put the film festival together on Wednesday and Thursday, and then we screen it Thursday night.
And where would somebody drop off a submission, and in what format should it be?
It can be in any digital format, and you can drop it off at the Alaska Robotics Gallery, which is at 220 Front Street. Right next to the movie theater there, downtown. And the only real rule we have is that films be 10 minutes or less, and that they have some kind of a Juneau connection. So that could be a filmmaker who's here in Juneau right now traveling through, or it could be someone who grew up in Juneau and lives outside, or someone who's making a film about Juneau, or, you know, it's pretty loose, but we like to have some kind of like Juneau affiliation to the film.
In the 15 years that the Jump Society has been producing independent films or collecting and showing independent films, about how many total films would you say have been shared with our community during that time?
More than 500.
That's a lot.
Yeah. And most of those are made right here in town. It's hours and hours and hours of footage if you put it all end to end. But it's really cool to see like what people have created over the years. And I know there's a lot that we're missing. There are a lot of really creative people. Every once in a while, I'll find someone on YouTube and I'll be like, oh man, why don't they submit to the film festival? And like, so a lot of cold calling people will be like, hey, your film's really good. Why don't we show it at the thing? It's been fun to do this for a while now and to see it evolve. And actually we have taken kind of a next step in our evolution. We have a bunch of board members now, and the Jump Society is a nonprofit, and it kind of has grown out of just like a couple people putting it together into an organization with a little bit more stability. I'm excited to see it go that way. And it's just been about 5 or 6 months now that we've started having meetings. And so this is kind of our first festival as a board.
Of the many people who have submitted entries into the Jump Society program over the years, have any of them gone on to work in the industry?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And several people have had long careers in various aspects of film and television before screening in the Jump Society. So, you probably know local filmmaker Joel Bennett is internationally recognized as a wildlife videographer. He submitted several films after having that career, which is really cool. But we have a lot of young people who grew up here in town, too, that went on to work in film. Bryce Habiger is a good example. He went up north and worked on a lot of production. Lael Rogers just actually... we hosted a screening of her films, and she's working in the film industry in Seattle and doing a lot of really interesting work. And she's really smart, really bright kid. She interned with us for a couple summers and submitted a bunch of films to the festival, and is now working on all kinds of production, ranging from music videos to film and television. And I think she was working on The Man in the High Castle recently, and has made some of her own films, and is just doing awesome work.
When you talk about an internship, you run a business that is a production company as well.
Right.
Talk about those opportunities and if there are other training and mentoring opportunities for up-and-coming filmmakers in Juneau.
I think that's something that we're working on right now. So like the Jump Society, we are looking at ways to do more community-oriented filmmaking. There's one of our board members, David Purdy, is really excited about doing more collaborative production. And I think that that's something that we are working towards in the next year or so. We're going to probably have a lot more educational opportunities and chances to partner on making things. One project we've talked about that I'm really excited about is trying to work with local nonprofits to, because a lot of times local nonprofits don't have the resources to make a film telling their story. It's tough for me as like, I have the business side of things. When a nonprofit comes to us and they want something made, and I know they can't, you know, it's like, oh, this is going to be a big bite out of your budget. What we've been talking about is trying to do something where we can get a group of filmmakers together in kind of an educational setting to work on telling that story. And it maybe won't be like as polished, but it can really be a learning tool for filmmakers and provide maybe kind of a documentary storytelling experience for a local nonprofit that wants to tell a story about what they're doing.
So it's a real-life opportunity for someone who would like that experience.
Yeah, so that's one of the things we're working towards. If people are excited about that, get a hold of us, and we'll give you more information about it as it develops.
And again, you're at the Robotic Shop on Front Street. We're talking with Pat Race.
Yeah.
He is one of the founders of the JUMP Society. JUMP stands for Juno Underground Motion Picture.
I was going to say, if people are interested in getting in touch with the JUMP Society, you can either come to the film festival screenings this weekend. We have screenings on Thursday night, Friday night, and Saturday night. Or you can visit our website, which is jumpsociety.org, and you can get in touch with us there.
And we should mention the screenings are at 7 on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, but also at 9 on Friday and Saturday at the Goldtown Nickelodeon Theater. I was surprised to hear it's all free.
Yeah, well, we accept donations. For sure. But if you don't have any money and you want to come enjoy the films, you're welcome to. Popcorn still costs money, though.
About how many films do you expect to offer in the festival? And is it the same cluster that's shown at each showing, or is it a variety and a series and you need to come to all of them? How will it be set up?
No, it's the same. It's the same set of films each showing. And so if you come on Thursday night, you're going to see the same films as on Friday night. And we just do that so that people get a chance to drop in at their convenience. What was the other
total number of films you think will be in each cluster?
It's hard to say right now. Generally, we get between 15 and 20. And they're all films that range from like 30 seconds to 10 minutes in length. This year, we've got some animation, some music videos, some documentary films. Some other areas of Alaska are represented. We've got some films that take place in Nome and on Alaska.
You said the only rule is associated with Juno and not longer than 10 minutes.
Yep, that's right.
Is that correct? How does somebody make a movie nowadays? You just take your iPhone and attach a microphone? I mean, tell me. We've got about a minute.
Sometimes people do that. Sometimes people are filming on their phones. Sometimes people are using a camera to make stop motion. Sometimes they have really nice production gear, and sometimes they're just kind of making do. But the thing that I've seen in the last, 5 to 10 years is that the equipment's come along so far that what you can do on a phone today is better than what you could do with professional gear, 15 years ago. It's pretty amazing.
If you're interested in local independent filmmaking, check out the festival, 7 o'clock Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and again at 9 on Friday and Saturday at Goldtown Nickelodeon. Thanks for joining us on a Juno afternoon. I'm Lori Scandling. Tomorrow we'll get an update on library activities. We'll get the scoop on the upcoming Lemon Creek cleanup, and Marciano Duran from Rotaract will talk about an upcoming fundraiser. Thanks for joining us.
Support for KTOO is provided by Davies Berry Insurance, serving southeastern Alaska since 1917, representing Allstate, Safeco, Progressive, as well as a variety of other carriers. 789-5900.